All right, welcome to a We Talk Music special interview. Today we have, well, really the founder of the hardest working band in Canada, Helix, Brian Vollmer. Welcome to We Talk Music, Brian Vollmer.
Great to be here, Brett.
All right, so let's jump right into Bastard of the Blues. Tell me a little bit about it and how it came about.
Kelly and I are the writers behind that album, and Sean's been my writing partner since 2008. And I was actually approached by Tom Mathers of Paris Records out of Houston, Texas, about putting out an album in 2014, and he offered me in advance. And we didn't even have the album written, and I said, sure, we can get the tunes together and get you an album. So Sean and I got together, and we just went crazy on it, and we finished up the album pretty quick. We had a lot of partial tunes that had been sitting around for a couple years, ever since the Skin in the Game and the Vagabond Bones album. So we put that together, and it came out in Paris Records in the United States and Europe. In Canada, I released it myself, and just took off. Was highly rated by all the rock magazines, and it got featured on Ron Keel's show out of Vegas, and D. Snyder had it up on his website. Eddie Trunk did an interview with me for KNAC, and so and on Sirius Radio. And then we went to Europe last year, and we toured across Spain. And then we went back in October, and we did October. We did Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. And we came back, we toured across Canada, and we even did a date down in the United States in Sioux Falls with Loverboy, April Wine, and Honeymoon Suite. So it was a great year last year, and it's continuing on this year. I'm actually going to an award show tonight, and we're up for Album of the Year at the University Station here in town. So cross your fingers, maybe we'll win that one.
Well, I totally hope that you do, because, I mean, we think Bastard of the Blues is fantastic. I mean,
thank you.
Overall, like, I would say that you guys seem to really be better than ever. So what made you kind of embrace who you are, and do you feel the same way musically now as you did before?
Yeah, I think your roots never change. I heard that from Lemmy from Motorhead once in an interview, but it's true. You know, the stuff you listen to when you started off listening to rock and roll is usually what influences you for most of your career. I still listen to new music, though, and you know, there's hints of that in the music as well. As far as Bastard of the Blues goes, what the song means is that our type of metal anyway is a product of rock and roll combined with blues, and it comes out like heavy metal, much like AC/DC, I would imagine. That's what the song's about. Some people get misled and think that we're putting out a blues album, but not really.
You know, hi, Brian, it's Mo here. I'm going to just jump in here. And first thing, I actually just want to ask you about the album. It seems a little random, perhaps, but the album cover, who did it? Because I think it's really cool.
The album cover was done by Matt Brooks and Baby Jack Design. I've used Matt ever since the Vagabond Bones album. He does great artwork for me. He does it all from scratch. And we take great care in every aspect of the album, right from the recording right down to the artwork. And I wanted something that we could take from the cover and put on T-shirts or posters, and it was going to stand out. I wanted something simple but yet very dramatic. And so I had an idea of a baby playing a guitar with double horns, and we started off and we went through several versions before we arrived at the little baby monster that we finally ended up with on the front cover. But I was very pleased with the results, and I'll use Matt, you know, as long as he keeps putting out art like that.
So with Bastard of the Blues, then, I know that in previous years, like as other members of the band have left, you've had to take on more roles. Now with some of those members back, like, are you still doing those roles, or is it other, or have you like doled it out a little bit?
I still pretty well run much run the band, but everybody does have a role in the band. Daryl's my right-hand man, and Daryl does a lot of sampling whenever we need it for the show. Sometimes it's just keyboards in the original track, and the album will program the keyboards just to fill it out when we're on stage, but it's never really a dominant thing. But Daryl is really my music to-go guy. He's my right-hand man. Fritz has got other jobs, Caleb and Chris, get together and practice their guitar parts. So we're a real team, and you're only as strong as your team. I got a great bunch of guys with me now, and hopefully I'll keep this lineup for a long time.
You know, it may just be my perception, but somehow it seems like Winning is the Best Revenge almost seems like the most personal song on the album. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Thinks I got a chip on my shoulder, but not really. But, in this business, there's a lot of things that can get you down and make you want to quit. For me, though, it's just continuing on. The turtle wins the race. And a lot of people over the years have told me to pack it in, that our type of music was outdated and dinosaur music, and I've just kept going, and somehow, some way, I always seem to make it to the next year and the next step, and I don't look too far ahead as far as going forward, and it always seems to work out for me. So, that's my attitude.
Some of those songs on this album, Metal at Midnight and Bastard of the Blues and All of Love is Gone, those are songs that I think would have been surefire radio hits back in another time. So, is there any frustration trying to get these songs heard by people now?
Well, the frustration lies in the fact that there's no real place for classic rock / metal acts to go to get new music played, and that's the reason I'm still in the music business nowadays. If I was just running around the circuit playing the old hits only, I don't think I could do it. It's too difficult, it's too hard, and quite frankly, there's not enough money to make me do something like that. But it's the putting out new music that keeps me going, because I just love creating new music, and that's where I get my kick in life. But the problem in Canada is that you would think that a classic rock band, when they have new music, would go to a classic rock station, but classic rock stations do not support new music by Canadian bands. And I've been told straight to my face by program directors that we don't care how good the song is, we're not going to play this. And I find that very frustrating.
That's bullshit, quite honestly.
But now with internet radio, we take a different approach. We get out there and we try to do as many interviews as we can with as many different internet radio stations and get the word out like that, through selling CDs at live gigs. And basically, you really got to take an active part in it. I try to post something on my Facebook site every day. Usually a little video clip. I just put one up today from back in 2007 when we were in Vancouver with the Trailer Park Boys. It could be from anywhere, and you need to keep that interest going, and you need to keep your name in front of people. We just licensed Rock You to the Trailer Park Boys for one of their upcoming episodes. Always out there pushing, working it.
Well, then, how have the Trailer Park Boys helped push your career even further?
Well, those guys are monsters. Everybody knows them, and very successful show, very successful live show as well. And so, I was in the second movie briefly, and there's that association with Helix. Because, Helix is Ricky's favorite band and Rush's Bubbles' favorite band. They took us on tour back in 2008, and we did 10 dates out in Western Canada. So that's all helped get our name out there, because they're so huge. We're kind of riding on their coattails to an extent, but they don't mind, so I surely don't mind.
Now, one of the keys for you, Planet Helix is such a great repository of your history, and I really appreciate the fact that you've put so much work into it. How important do you think that history and like really continuing to illustrate it is for your band and other bands?
I think it's essential. And you know, years ago, I decided to model Helix after Ronnie Hawkins. And what I mean by that is that I thought of Ronnie Hawkins, I thought, well, everybody knows who Ronnie Hawkins is, but if you take the average person off the street, probably very few of them could give you two songs that Ronnie Hawkins ever sang. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, well, he must promote himself pretty good, which he does. And so I just decided that I was going to do the same thing. And luckily, my manager of many years, Bill Sipe, taught me how to work radio, how to approach magazines and radio stations and TV stations to get press. And so I became my own publicist, really.
Well, you know, one of the things that actually we had heard about you was how approachable you were, that you definitely have that reputation, approachable to your fans and to the media. And how important is that, and how important is it just to kind of stay humble when you're a rock star?
Well, you know, if you don't, you know, on the way up it's fine, but on the way down there's you're in a free fall if you've been a dick to get where you got to. So, but we've always had that very grassroots approach to our fans. We've always been accessible. Even in the bars, we never hit up in our rooms between sets. We were always out there mingling with the audience. A lot of friends that we met back in those early bar days are still our friends today. And they keep it going, and now their kids are coming out to the shows. So for us especially, it's been everything, keeping that close touch with the fans.
Well, what about the some of the history that we see? You had a book that you came out in 2004, 2005, and you had a documentary in 2005. I think 30 years of Helix. You could see updated version of these. Maybe get them on Netflix. Maybe get a digital Kindle version. Things like that out there.
Well, right now we're working on a couple different projects that have to do with video. We have a film maker that's been working with us named Dave Cardoso, and he came with us over to Europe last year and took quite an extensive amount of footage, and he's putting together a new bio, a rockumentary for later on in the year. Hopefully we'll get that together. He's also working with me to put together a internet TV show. It's reality, unreality show, we like to call it. And it's called The Volmers, and it's basically based from here at Planet Helix. Features me and Linda and all the wacky people we meet during the course of our daily lives. And that's going to be a real fun project once we start rolling on it. The hardest part is to get through the first episode and basically walk through the whole process, how we're going to put it together and how the music's going to go, and just basically putting it together.
Yeah, because I had read on Wikipedia, actually, that you were looking at a reality series as of November 2010, so it's certainly taken a little while to put the pieces in place, eh?
Well, originally we started off, we were going to try to put something together with another cameraman and approach the networks, but that didn't pan out. And so when I met Dave, and Dave from over to Europe, and I saw his work, he's very good with the camera, we discussed how we were going to do this on a low budget. And essentially what we've done is we've taken the reality shows work with lots of money, and we're doing a guerrilla version of that idea when we do the Volmers. Whereas in those high production things that are on TV, like the Wahlbergs or Duck Dynasty, basically they have a storyline or two storylines will run through each episode, and they'll have a certain film clip, you know, Donnie gets married or something, and then they'll have a very controlled environment where they film other people making comments on the piece of film you just said, or something to piece together the different parts of the story until you get to the end of the episode. Basically, they're all pretty much the same, only instead of filming with high-priced cameras and that, I'm just going to film with my handheld high-def, and then we're going to do the in-between in a controlled environment with Dave's camera. So we'll see how it goes, and we'll know after what episode. Either it'll look really, really hokey, or people will like it. So we'll decide at that time whether or not we're going to proceed further.
Well, I know we want to see it, but I'll tell you, you must have a real like storehouse of Helix stuff over the years, eh?
I get too much stuff. I was just looking at some of the film that I've taken since 2006 now, and I have a whole basket full of mini CDs which have about 20 minutes in each one, and there's something like 170 of those. I have 8 hours of videotape in my basement from when we toured with Ian Gillan in 1989, just before Paul died, and I haven't even watched all 8 hours. And that was back in 1989, plus I got all sorts of other video tape down there, my old home movies. God, I don't know where to start. I need to take 6 months off just to sit and watch it all.
Well, if you ever need an archivist, then we'll happily volunteer for the job. But
this guy over here is actually professional. He's actually a professional editor as well, so video editor.
Oh,
so
that's good to hear.
Yeah, you know what? He's always looking to earn an extra buck working for someone he respects like yourself. So.
So
come on now, you were volunteering. Now you're talking money.
All right, well, you know what? Money means the send us a copy of your book. That'll be good.
So, have you considered doing another solo album, or are you pretty much locked in with Helix now?
Oh, I'd love to do another solo album. It's just time-wise, I'm a little bit tight right now, but I'll probably put another solo album. I might actually do a cover solo album. I have a little cover band that I go out with sometimes on the weekends, and there's a lot of older songs, kind of like semi-hits, that I'd like to do rather than the obvious songs that people would know.
Yeah, because we listened to When Pigs Fly, and it's definitely got a different sound than regular Helix.
Yeah, so that was an album I wrote with Bill Gadd, Tony Pelleschi, and Rob Long, and essentially, I got in this little weekend cover band, and these guys hadn't really ever written a song before, and we started writing songs, and we just ended up doing an album, and some of the songs were quite good.
You know, it's one of the things you mentioned was some of the songs that you want to do, the cover songs, are the more obscure ones. I mean, you brought out a couple of obscure Canadian songs in the 80s, like, A Foot in Cold Water. And, Give Me Some Loving, that was, what was the name of that band? Crazy Elephant or White Elephant?
Crazy
or?
Elephant, I think, yeah.
Crazy Elephant, that wasn't a Canadian band, though. That was an American band.
Were they American? Either way, though, I mean, where do you find these? Where do you find these were these songs that influenced you? Is that how you picked them back in the day, or were they kind of brought to you, or how did you find those two songs?
Well, sometimes I discovered the music. For instance, my wife turned me on to Super Lungs. Have you ever heard that song?
No.
Who did Super Lungs, hon?
Terry Reid.
Terry Reid sang that song. It was a big hit in England, so I found out about that song through my wife. Terry Reid was actually the guy that was supposed to be the original singer of Led Zeppelin.
That's right, yeah. Terry Reid's really good.
Yeah, and Frankie Miller, another guy I discovered through my wife. And one of my favorite singers. I'd love to do a Frankie Miller song. And there's other songs by Canadian bands, too. We did A Touch of Magic by James LeRoy on the acoustic album. That was a huge hit in Canada and never really got out of this country. And there's all sorts of April Wine songs. Scrubble O'Kane was another band. They had a great song called Crazy About a Blues Guitar with Paul Dean playing and Henry Small doing lead vocal chores.
So, now you have a great voice. And
thank you.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, you know, we've listened to it for years, and it has not changed. I mean, you've done a fantastic job. But I'm interested in, like, also, who are some of the other people out there that you think have a great voice?
Darby Mills still has her pipes after all these years. You know, even Lee Aaron, I saw her a little while ago. As far as American bands go, Kix, have you ever seen that band?
Yeah, oh, Steve yeah. Whiteman.
What's his name, the singer?
Steve Whiteman.
Steve Whiteman, that's correct. He's got a great voice, and he's a fantastic showman. You know, the Choir Boys. There's lots of bands out there. The guys are still kicking it. Some of them aren't, but a lot of them kept the chops up. Ron Keel. Todd Kearns, who is a Canadian boy that plays bass for Slash. He's got an amazing voice. I don't know if you ever heard Todd sing or not. He's from Saskatchewan. Mike Reno, there's another guy who can sing just as good as he ever did.
Yeah, I just saw him a couple of years ago. It was a great show. You talk about the front men. What are some of the front men that, I mean, that's a completely different skill set than singing. So who are some of the guys who you think that are just a great showman?
Well, I liked all the whiskey-throated guys like Mick Jagger, Robert Plant, Steve Marriott, Paul Rogers. I love Lemmy from Motorhead. He isn't really a classic front man, but really is a front man. There's so many of them out there.
What is it about them that stands out? Is it just the presence they have on stage?
Yes, they're just really good at their craft. I think the best showman I've ever seen in my entire life is Prince.
Yeah, you're probably right. I hadn't even thought about it, but you're probably right as soon as you bring it up. Great show.
You know, I don't have one Prince album, but when I went to see him in concert, he was just absolutely amazing. And just when you think the guy couldn't do anything else or play any other instrument, he comes out and dances alone for 15 minutes. And you go, oh, my God, what's he going to do next, fly across the auditorium?
I have seen that, actually. not out of Prince, though. But.
So what are some of the songs that you think to yourself, that's your best vocal performance, that you're proud of, that they're captured on tape that you'd like people to listen to?
Oh, that's a toughie.
No, they're supposed to be toughies. We're here to challenge you.
Well, I really like a song I wrote on the Business Doing Pleasure album called Tug of War. I thought that was a great song. Not necessarily the songs that the fans might have as their favorites, but Best Mistake I Never Made. I really thought that was a good song.
Love that song. I want to put that on the end of this podcast, if that's all right with you, in fact.
That'd be fine. That was about a girl I almost married from California, result of my big head following my little head. The Storm, probably.
Yeah, that's tremendous, tremendous, for sure.
Deep Cuts a Knife was another one I was proud of, the vocal track I did on that.
That's awesome.
That's a good question.
So,
and then I've done other stuff. I've done classical stuff. I sang Ave Maria and Sean Kelly's last classical guitar album.
Wow.
Yeah, because that's actually on YouTube. I mean, exceptional. And I know that that's one of the things that I find most interesting about you is the fact that you have the range, of course, and the ability to do both. And so well.
Well, I was lucky because the worst moment of my life turned out to be the best moment of my life. And the worst moment of my life was back in 1976 when I was told by a throat specialist I would never sing again, and that if I didn't quit singing, I wouldn't be able to talk in a couple of years. And I was sent by my manager at that time, William Sipe, to a voice teacher in Hamilton by the name of Ed Johnson, who taught everybody that was on the Southern Ontario circuit back then. And he took me aside and he said, "Luckett," he said, "just study with me, do what I tell you to do, and your nodes, I had nodes and polyps in my vocal cords. He said, your nodes will go away. And after a year, and I didn't take any time off from being on the road, I was still playing 6-7 nights a week, my nodes went away. But it took literally years till my voice repaired itself, and then it just started to get better and better and better. My voice is actually better this year, and I'll be 60 this year than when I was 18 years old. And I give it all due to learning bel canto, which is the singing technique I was taught by Ed Johnson. I studied with him for over 30 years, and I was with him when he died. Actually, I stayed the last week with him in the hospital when he was in a coma, and I think in the last hour, Ray Lyle, remember Ray Lyle?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Sure. Ray Lyle in the Storm is...
Ray Lyle in the Storm.
Are you kidding me?
Ray came in and paid his respects, and Ray left, and then I left, and about 10 minutes later, Ed passed away, so...
Yeah, Ray Lyle was another one of my favorites. I know he's a good friend of yours. It's a different style of music. He's more of that Heartland rock style, I guess, I think he just had a new album come out, was it a year ago or so?
I'm not sure about that. I'm very good friends with Ray, but I don't keep track of what Ray does because he seems to do a different thing every week.
He's a talented guy, too.
He's a very talented individual, very inventive and imaginative, creative.
So what are some of the funniest guys out there when you've been on a tour with? Or some of the guys who've made you laugh the most, maybe a prank story or something like that?
Well, my own drummer, Fritz, has got to be one of the funniest guys I've ever met. And Fritz has played some really great pranks. He played one of me going to Europe. I was all stressed out about going to Europe in October for various reasons. But we got to the airport, and we got through, and they stopped. They always stop Caleb, my one guitar player, because he looks like Jesus and also a dope fiend. So they always pull him aside, and... Anyway, they pull him aside once again, and we got on the other side. And anyway, I phoned Fritz. I said, what's happening? He says, oh, they got him in there. They're grilling him, right? And I don't know. I don't think they're going to let him through. And he's going on like this. This went on for an hour, right? Meanwhile, Fritz and those guys had already gone through. We're sitting at a restaurant having a beer. They were putting me on. Here I am, I'm all stressed out, thinking, oh no, so we're not going to get on the plane, oh, this is going to all screw up. Anyway, someone went, what? And Caleb's going, I told you you shouldn't have done that to him.
I'm sure there's a ton of those kind of things from your career, no question.
So... Yeah, we've had a lot of funny times, good times, party times, and that's one of the reasons I do what I do, because it is so much fun when you're out there.
So then, if there was like a dream tour lineup that you would want Helix on, just like for any bands, like which lineup would that be? Yeah, just of like if you could go tour with Kiss again or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, basically, who are the guys that you'd want to hang out with on a long tour? Who are the guys, both either for musically or just personality wise, you got along with and you'd love to be with and do one more time?
Oh, there's a lot of nice people I've met on the road. Neil Murray from Whitesnake is a good friend of mine. Bernie Shaw, Uriah Heep. Stat Howland's a good friend of mine. I was actually just emailing him yesterday, the old drummer for Wasp. Probably people like that I already know that I'm comfortable with.
So if we were to play a little word association, just throw out a name or a band, maybe you have an opinion or a memory or a story or whatever, would that be all right?
Sure.
Yeah? Well, let's start with one that's not even a... not even a musician, but I know that you met Robin Williams, and I'm wondering if you would kind of relate that story and your thoughts about his recent passing.
Very funny guy. I met him with Richard Pryor and Rip Taylor, and he did a little skit for me from my Super 8 sound camera. He said, this is for the Queen, wherever he may be, and for those Canadians sneaking into the United States, otherwise known as Frostbacks. And he was was looking at the girls in the video all dressed in leather and skimpily dressed, and he said you can always tell what religion a woman is by the clothes she's wearing. It was a sad thing to see him die. You know, he obviously had some problems. Apart from that, I can't say too much.
How about Eddie Van Halen?
Met Eddie Van Halen down in, I believe it was Louisville, Kentucky, with when we were on the hard tour. He actually jumped on stage while Brent was doing his guitar solo and was dancing around with Ann Wilson's handmade acoustic guitar. I said to the security guy beside me, I said, hey, aren't you going to get that guy off stage? And he goes, he looked at me deadpan and goes, you get him off stage. That's Eddie Van Halen. And we came off stage, and Eddie and Alex were there, and Brent was so dumbfounded, he didn't know what to say. Suddenly he goes, you want to come upstairs for a beer? And they went, yep. And they came up, and they talked to us, and they were really nice. They told us about, Eddie was talking about a new hammer technique he was going to do on the next album. Now you hear it all the time, that hammer pull type of thing. And it was one of the high points of my life, a special time.
Now, you mentioned Wasp earlier. So how about Blackie Lawless?
Blackie was a funny guy. I enjoyed touring with Wasp. Blackie's first and foremost a businessman, very business oriented type of guy. He really ran that band with an iron fist. Didn't let the guys do too much. I remember Chris Holmes used to come over our dressing room and ask if he could smoke in our dressing room because Blackie wouldn't let him smoke in theirs.
Wow.
He came over one time and he goes, he says, yeah, we have a one-eyed cat at home. He said, when we get really really screwed up at parties, he said, we put M&Ms in the empty eye sockets.
Oh, wow.
Another time we were at Long Beach Arena, and we were sitting there, and me and Paul, and it was a sold-out gig that night, 20,000 people, and this guy showed up with, I think it was a Lato guitar, I'm not sure what make, but it was a free endorsement for Chris Holmes. It had this beautiful, beautiful paint job on some mural or something on the guitar. And so he's sitting there and he's stringing his guitar, and me and Paul are there, and Paul's playing his guitar, and Paul says, oh, Chewy, because that was Chris Holmes' nickname. He says, Chewy, he says, that's a beautiful guitar. And Chris Holmes kind of picks it up, and he looks at the paint job, and so he puts it down, he reaches over, and he grabs a screwdriver, and he goes, ah! He starts stabbing and scraping the guitar, and just ramming the screwdriver into the guitar body and ripping it apart, right? And he looks up, and he goes, that was Wasp.
That's awesome. So let's shift gears then to what about Chuck Berry?
Chuck Berry, obviously the king of rock and roll.
King of rock and roll. Let's go David Lee Roth.
David Lee Roth, great showman. In our career, he probably had a heavy influence when, you know, they were really happening. Funny story about David Lee Roth. We were one of the first times we were in L.A., we were cruising down through Hollywood. We were actually on tour with Michael Bolton, and we were playing the Beverly Theater, and we pulled up to a stop sign. David Lee Roth pulled up beside our, can't remember if we were in a bus room. I think we were in a bus at that time, and David Lee Roth was in this black Mercedes with the red skull and crossbones on the hood, and he just kind of looked over and gave us the old Dave nod, and we were all, oh, wow, David Lee Roth, man. So that's my David Lee Roth story.
That's not bad at all. That's not a bad story at all. I forgot that Michael Bolton was before he became that blue-eyed soul kind of guy, that he was a metal guy.
Yeah, and I actually went bowling with Michael Bolton at the Hollywood Bowl, no less. There was me and Mickey Thomas from Jefferson Starship and Michael Bolton saw all these other stars. We were bowling for charity for something or other.
Wow. So was that like in the blackjack days, or was that in the post blackjack days?
What's black? Blackjack mean?
Blackjack was Michael Bolton's band before.
He knows everything.
Before he became Michael Bolton, I guess. But
it was 1983. It was the first time we ever went to California.
Wow.
And we played, I'm telling you exactly, we played Keystones in Palo Alto, Keystones in San Francisco, in the Beverly Theater in San Francisco. I remember driving by the Brown Derby and it was all boarded up. It was quite the mismatch of acts, Helix and Michael Bolton, but he was the nicest guy. He always treated us really good. And then he went on to become super famous.
Well, how about another Canadian singer, Sebastian Bach?
Sebastian's a good friend of mine. I initially met Baz when we closed up the Gosfords in Toronto, and then I saw him again when we played over in Sweden Rock about around 2006. I ended up riding back on the bus with him all the way from Malmo to Copenhagen, and that was a wild ride, to say the least. He'd been up all night, and we had to drive to the airport in Copenhagen. And when I put my autobiography out in whatever the year was, he wrote a foreword to it, so little comment in the back. And I've seen, last time I saw him, he was in town with Guns N' Roses at the JLC downtown.
Let's go with Ozzy Osbourne.
Ozzy I've never played with, but ironically I've played with most of the other singers of Sabbath. In fact, we did three dates with Sabbath in 1983 in New York State, and Ian Gillan was singing for them. But we also played with Ryan James Dio. In fact, some of the first dates we did were with Dio in Oklahoma City, Phoenix, and Albuquerque. We also played with Dio at CNE Stadium in Toronto. Never ever met Ozzy. That's, I don't know what to say about that.
That's fine.
How about Alice Cooper then?
Alice Cooper, we toured with a couple of years ago. Big influence on my career. I actually took care of Alice's snake from Kitchener all the way out to the East Coast. It had its own bunk in a Tupperware container. But Alice was another guy, a total gentleman. We set it up with his manager to meet him, and they took us down after one of the shows down the hallway. And when they took us in the room with Alice, they told us before we went in, they went, "Look, it's just you and Alice Cooper, and you can take pictures and ask whatever questions you want, and he's yours for as long as you want him." And sure enough, he never hurried us out of the room. He took pictures with us. He talked to us. And for a famous performer like that to show us respect, it means everything to a younger band. Not that we're younger in age, but do you know what I mean? Like, not Alice Cooper.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. We'll just do a couple more of these, and we've taken enough of your time. But, I mean, we could throw names at you, I think, all day, because I think you played with, you played with everybody, haven't you?
People, yeah.
Did you know Jamie Lane?
Jamie Lane, I actually sang with. When they came and played in London at Centennial Hall, I got up and sang Tush with them.
Oh, awesome. Wow. Awesome. Yeah, I was a big fan of Jamie Lane. Dee Snider.
Dee Snider, I met just last year. We played down in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, as I said, with April Wine, Honeymoon Suite, and Loverboy. And the next day, Dee Snider came in, I think Tom Kiefer and a few other people, right? And I actually got to meet Dee and gave him the new album, Bastard of the Blues. And he said, "Well, I'm not really the person that you give it to. You got to give it to," and he told us the name of this other person. But I ended up seeing that he put up the video, I believe, on his website about a month later. So thanks, Dee, if you're out there.
And Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley.
Well, we played Open Up for Kiss on the whole Lick It Up tour across Europe in 1983. We were the first band ever to play with Kiss with their makeup off. I saw Gene and Paul pretty much every day.
Awesome. All right, well, is there any other song? We'll take, we'll put a couple songs at the end here. Do you have anything that you want us to put on?
Bastard of the Blues, Even Jesus.
All right, excellent. And anything else you want to say to everybody out there?
Just thank thanks to all the fans, and thanks to you guys for having me on the show, for your support. That's what keeps the band going. We don't get a lot of airplay through traditional means anyway, so it's our fans that keep us going, and our fans coming to the gigs that buy our music still, and that's what keeps us going. And, you know, if we have that continued support, we'll be around for another 20 years.
Well, we are certainly proud to keep flying the flag and hope that Helix carries on for as long as you want to. So, Brian Vollmer, we certainly appreciate you being on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And certainly good luck at your show tomorrow, and good luck with the awards.
Thanks a lot. Well, you know, I'm up against one of my students, actually.
Oh, that's
well, you know, kick his ass.
Up against a girl named Sarah Smith, and I think she's going to be a big star.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, thank you very much, sir. And, you know, we'll look forward to next time you're in Calgary.
Okay, looking forward to seeing you, too.
Saloon town, but when your gums are flapping at the end of the bar, remember that your bullshit doesn't have to travel too far. You say I'm a loser, but I'm running on a dream. I'm a freight train coming at ya, full steam. Try to undermine me at every twist and turn, but I'm a fire starter and you're gonna get burned. You say I'm a loser, but I'm running on a dream. I'm your worst nightmare coming at ya, full steam.
Winning is a bad. and love in his hometown. Even Jesus, even Jesus was in love in his hometown. Even Jesus, even Jesus was in love in his hometown. Even Jesus was in love, in love, in love. Even Jesus was in love in his hometown. Even Jesus, 'cause even Jesus was in love in his hometown. Even Jesus.
Daddy's evil ways, I'm ashamed they kept locked in the attic, hidden from the day. And if you ask me my name, I won't deny it.
man am I, so don't you try.